An e-bow is just what it sounds like, an electronic bow used by guitarists to simulate their strings and give themselves a legato sound. It's appeared on countless hit records and is definitely one of those things that once you start noticing it, you can't really stop. Welcome to Strong Songs, a podcast about music. I'm your host, Kirk Hamilton, and I'm so glad you've joined me to talk about music played by e-bows, music played by regular bows, music played by fingers, plectrums, mallets, and more. Strong Songs is entirely independent, made entirely without compromise, thanks to the fact that it is entirely funded by donations from listeners like you. That is such a cool thing, and I really appreciate everyone out there who's chipped in on Patreon to keep this thing going. On this episode, we're going back to an earlier era of American music when a handful of bands from the Pacific Northwest reimagined what a rock band could sound like and what they could sing about. It's a band that I'm very excited to talk about, so let's drop the sixth string, power up the amps, and hit this thing. When I was a kid in the early 90s, grunge wasn't really my thing. I was 11 years old when Nevermind came out. I wasn't old enough to understand the late Reagan-era alienation that drove so many young adults to feel so frustrated and alone. I was shifting from action figures to the saxophone at the time. I thought it was pretty cool when Bill Clinton went and played tenor on Arsenio. The dark, hard-hitting sounds emanating from the Pacific Northwest just didn't really resonate with me. Later, of course, I would come to appreciate, admire, and even love a lot of the rock bands that defined the post-hair metal sound of the early 90s, Nirvana, Alice in Chains, Stone Temple Pilots, and above all, Soundgarden. But at the time, it just wasn't my thing. I was into They Might Be Giants and Charlie Parker. I was 12. My antipathy was reinforced by what I saw on MTV, grainy videos of young men in baggy clothes with long, unkempt hair thrashing around with guitars as the camera shook from the impact of their power chords. And while there are a handful of music videos that would go on to define the visual aesthetic of the grunge era, none stuck with me nearly as hard as the video for Soundgarden's Black Hole Sun. The video, directed by Howard Greenhalgh, basically depicts the end of the world, but in the creepiest way possible. In it, a group of suburbanites go about their daily life, and their smiles and pleasant expressions gradually begin to distend and distort, stretching to nightmarish proportions. The image of a curly-haired blonde woman, eyes bugging, grinning mouth stretched into a toothy maw, meat cleaver in hand as she leans over a fish on a cutting board. That image is seared forever into my brain, and I'm guessing I'm not the only one. I'm guessing some of you out there are picturing exactly what I'm picturing right now as I'm describing it. I found this video so disturbing, yet so entrancing, and for years I thought only of it and never of the song that it accompanied. To me, Black Hole Sun was that video. I couldn't hear the song, I could only see it. Many, many years later, as I began to learn guitar and study songwriting, I returned to the grunge era and revisited the classic records that I'd found too edgy and off-putting in my sheltered youth. And guess what? I found a lot to love. I liked a lot of the bands that I listened to, but none of them knocked me out quite like Soundgarden. It actually started with their song Spoon Man, which, as it happens, follows Black Hole Sun on their groundbreaking 1994 record Super Unknown. I liked everything about this song. From there, I got reacquainted with Soundgarden as an ensemble, lead guitarist Kim Thile, bassist Ben Shepherd, Matt Cameron on the drums, and lead singer and songwriter Chris Cornell wailing over top it all with his powerful trademark screams. Soundgarden was among the more technical of the grunge acts of the early 90s. They wore their heavy metal and even prog influences more clearly than some of their contemporaries, and I was extremely here for it. So after hearing that song, I found myself sitting down with Super Unknown, and a few tracks in, I heard that familiar opening guitar part. And so for the first time, I closed my eyes and pushed out those incredible, indelible images of distended domestic apocalypse, and I just listened, and oh man, this was a great song. In my eyes, indisposed, in disguises, no one knows, has the fit. And thus began my actual adult relationship with Soundgarden, one of my favorite 90s rock bands, and one that's emblematic of how my musical tastes have changed and expanded as I've gotten older. On this episode, we're going to go deep into Soundgarden's most famous hit song, Black Hole Sun, to push beyond that memorable music video and get into the music itself, so we can better understand what makes this song and this band so great. Black Hole Sun, won't you come? Wash away. Black Hole Sun was written by Soundgarden frontman Chris Cornell in what sounds like a very organic process. Sometimes you just write songs that way. They kind of come to you and you go from one melody and one chord to the next. And before you know it, you've got a whole song. It was produced, like the rest of Super Unknown, by Michael Beinhorn, now known as one of the defining rock producers of the 1990s. Both sonically and compositionally, Black Hole Sun is a little bit different than what Soundgarden had been doing up to that point. As guitarist Kim Thayil described in an interview with Song Facts, it was, quote, more singer-songwriter-ish, unquote, and perhaps as a result, it was a bigger mainstream hit. And you can hear that if you sit down with Super Unknown and listen to the whole album. The album rocks, but Black Hole Sun kind of stands apart. There's a little bit more space, a little bit more verticality with the vocals, there are some more interesting textures with the guitars, and just a bit less of Cornell's defining vocal attribute, which is his scream. The guy can scream like no one else, and he doesn't really do very much screaming on Black Hole Sun. I guess singer-songwriter-ish isn't actually a bad way to describe it. So let's get into it. Black Hole Sun is in the key of G, though it follows a twisting, downward-sloping chord progression that moves pretty well outside of G for a large percentage of the song. And that downward slope is very important. I want to continue Season 6's focus on directionality in songwriting and on the trajectories of chord progressions and melodies to keep reinforcing that way of listening, to keep helping you notice that. Hearing the paths and shapes in the music, seeing its upward climbs and downward slopes clearly. And while Black Hole Sun does have its moments of ascent, particularly in Cornell's vocal melody and in some of the guitar parts, it is by and large a descending song, spiraling downward again and again. The actual chords of the song are a bit unusual if you write them out. There's a lot of sus chords, there's a 7 chord with no third, a lot of add 2 chords. So if you're learning the song on the piano or reading a chord chart for it, it feels one way, but the minute you learn it on guitar, it all makes a different sort of sense. This is very much a guitar player's song, and it was written according to the logic of the guitar fretboard, specifically the guitar fretboard in drop D tuning. Like a lot of rock songs, Black Hole Sun is played in drop D, which means that the 6th string on the guitar, which is normally tuned to a low E, 2 octaves below the 1st string, the higher E, is tuned down a step to a D. That tuning gives the guitar a bigger, deeper range and allows for access to a couple of crucial extra notes and, in general, makes it easier to finger chords that involve larger intervals down low, which helps them cut through a bit more clearly and opens up a lot more possibilities down in the lower parts of the guitar. Let's take a look at that opening guitar part, which traces the first few chords of the verse. The first chord is a G sus 4, which is like a G major chord with a C, the fourth, in place of the B, the third. Now, if I were to demonstrate that on the piano, I'd start by playing a G major chord, which I would play like this. G, B, D, and then another G up an octave on top. To turn that into a G sus chord, I'd just take the B and I'd raise it up to a C and I would get this. That's probably a familiar sound to a lot of you. That's the start of the Hallelujah cadence that resolves from the sus chord back to major. However, Cornell's guitar part doesn't voice the chord that way. It takes those same four notes, G, C, D, and G, and it blows them out a little bit and drops them lower, so it's in a different order. It goes G, D, G up the octave, and then C above that. G, D, G, C. Let's hear that on the guitar. Now, the minute you play those four notes on a drop D-tuned guitar, you realize why it works so well and why Cornell played it that way. You're just laying your finger across the fretboard on the fifth fret and playing the lowest four strings, one right after the other. The next chord, which is a B-flat 6-9, is very similar. The top three notes stay the same, G, D, C, and the bottom note just moves up to be a B-flat. So we go from this to this. On guitar, that sounds like this going to this. It's very logical to play on guitar. You just move your pinky up on the sixth string and keep everything else in the same place. The rest of the chords on the intro fit into similar shapes with some small tweaks. There's a stack of two F power chords for an F5, then the same thing in E, then an E-flat sus voiced the same as that G, and then the final chord is a D7 with no third, which lets that lowest D, the dropped D, ring out. Put all those chords together and you get something spacey and distinct, blown out sus chords stacked in fourths and fifths, moving down the lowest parts of the guitar neck in a very logical, easy to play way. Now listen to the actual recording and you'll hear a second guitar part, a second musical element that's crucial to the vibe of this intro. So what is that sound, that weird, keening, warbling sound? It sounds like a guitar, but also not like a guitar? That is, in fact, a guitar, modified with a number of cool effects that make it sound pretty distinct from your average electric guitar. For starters, it's being put through some sort of a rotary speaker, which becomes more pronounced during the verse, so I'll talk a little more about that effect then. The main thing in effect during this intro is what sounds to me like an e-bow, which is a cool little device invented by a guy named Greg Heat that has been in use since the early 70s. So you can bow an electric guitar, you can bow any stringed instrument, and plenty of electric guitar players have bowed an electric guitar in the past, but it's kind of tricky to do it. So an e-bow aims to replicate that effect. It's shaped like a little black thumb, and you place it over a given guitar string, and it causes that string to vibrate on its own and generate a continuous tone without needing you to actually pluck the string. The result is an endless tone, basically infinite sustain, much like a bowed string on a violin or a viola or something like that. And when combined with guitar effects, particularly overdrive, you can get some pretty cool sounds and some pretty cool isolated harmonics. So while I'm not 100% sure that this intro guitar is using an e-bow, it sounds like an e-bow to me. It's something pretty similar anyways. And I'm going to use an e-bow to try to get the effect combined with that roto vibe effect, as well as what sounds like some tape delay, which duplicates the original guitar signal and pushes it out across the stereo pan to make the whole thing just sound bigger and more reverberant. All right, now let's put those two guitar parts together and we'll have a recreation of our intro. It's a vibey intro in more ways than one, and it sets the tone for the song to come. So with that tone set, let's get into the verse.
In my eyes, indisposed, in disguises no one knows, has the face like
So I want to start with this song's harmony. As I said, Black Hole Sun is in the key of G, but I should mention here near the beginning that I'm doing a bit of retuning in order to make this work for this episode. The actual recording of the song is quite a bit sharper than G, to the point that it's almost in G sharp, even though when the band actually plays this song live, they play it very squarely in the key of G. So for whatever reason, my guess is the final recording was tuned up to be a bit brighter and possibly a bit faster too. I'm not really sure what happened there. But for this episode, I've tuned it down to get it into the key of G, since it'll be a lot easier for me to recreate it, and also because that's the way they play it live. But some of the more eagle-eared out there among you might be noticing that, and I wanted to acknowledge it, just so you don't think you're losing your mind.
In my eyes, indisposed, in disguises no one knows, has the face lies the snake in the sun in my disgrace.
So I want to go through the chords of the verse, but rather than focusing too much on chord names or chord qualities, I want you to pay attention to the direction that the chords are moving. Namely, this starts on a G, the one chord, a G major, really a G major 6, then it goes up to B flat, and then it begins to descend. It goes down to F, then down to E minor, then down to E flat major, and then down to D, the lowest note in the chord progression, before going up to G, to F, and ending up on A flat, just one half step above the root. That's a very tense final chord for the phrase that eventually resolves back around to G. So let me begin my recreation, but I'm actually going to start with Ben Shepherd's bass line and Matt Cameron's drum part so that you can really just focus on the direction that the chords are moving. I'll play along on piano in octaves with the bass line and just try to picture the contour of this sequence of notes. So it starts on G, then goes up, then begins to go down, then down again, all the way down to D, and then G, F, and A flat. So if you're picturing that bass line as an actual line in your mind's eye, it moves up and then it moves down and so on. Let's put the melody line on top of those bass notes so we can start to picture it as a second line placed atop the first lower line. The melody starts with these three notes, B, D, E, and that E will come back for the next two phrases. The E is a focal note for the first three chords of the song, but it means something different over each of those chords. Here, listen to the recording and I'll emphasize each time he sings an E.
In my
eyes, there's an E.
Indisposed,
another one.
In disguises, no one knows.
So over a G, the E is the 6, so we have a slightly less usual sounding G6 chord. On the next phrase, the chord moves up to a B-flat, but the melody stays on the E. So over B-flat, the E becomes the tritone, which is a sharp 4, and that brings out this sort of Lydian shine to that B-flat chord. He keeps singing the E, he sings it a third time over the F chord, which becomes a major 7th. So we have another unusual sound, an F major 7 sound. So if you take any of those three chords on its own, it doesn't sound that strange, but when you put them together and place that melody over them, it starts to sound a lot more distinct, which is a big part of why this song sounds the way that it does.
In my eyes, indisposed, in disguise,
It's such a distinctive opening line. It really grabs you, the way he smacks that E over and over again, and that E changes context depending on what the band is playing underneath him. It's just such a strong melody, and that's borne out by how open this song is for reinterpretation. I really like Norah Jones's version of this song, which she's recently been making part of her live set.
In my eyes, indisposed, in disguises no one knows, as the face lies.
You can really hear how the strength of the original composition lends itself to a musician like Jones reinterpreting it. This song became such a part of the firmament in the 90s that it's easy to take it for granted, but I really do want to just focus in on that melody and remind ourselves that this song didn't exist, and then Chris Cornell thought of it, and then it did. So after those first two lines, he walks the melody down through that chromatic sequence of chords, F down to E, down to E flat, down to D, and on the D he does a very Beatles-y melodic turn right here. That jump of a sixth, it's from the fifth scale degree up to the third, so that's a D up to a B in the key of G. Putting that at the end of the phrase will always sound like "In My Life" to me. Did you catch that? We're in the key of A, but it's at the end of basically every phrase in this song. I'm not sure if this was the first song to do this. It probably wasn't, but it'll always be the song that I associate with this melodic move.
I still can recall, some are dead and some are living. In my life, I've loved them all.
So while it's 30 years later and a very different style of music, when Chris Cornell sings this melody,
as the face lies the snake in the sun in my disgrace,
I at least hear that Beatles connection. So now let me play the melody just with the bass and drums, leaving out that guitar counter melody and all those cool extra effects that are happening, because I want you to really focus your mind's eye. Close your eyes if it helps, but try to see those two lines moving in concert with one another. Sometimes they move together, sometimes they move apart, and they're always creating interesting tensions in the distances between them. Okay, ears on, here we go. You see it?
In my eyes, indisposed, in disguises no one knows, as the face lies the snake in the sun in my disgrace.
So hopefully you're really seeing it now. Those two lines, the bass and the melody, moving together to climb and then descend through the phrase. So now let's add that final crucial element. I believe this is Kim Thayil, but it may also be Cornell, still using that rotary effect from the intro, now providing three note shapes on top of each chord, which really expand the harmonic space of the whole verse, and also stand in interesting contrast to the directional movement of the bass line and the melody. So let's talk about triads for a minute. A triad is, as you might guess, a grouping of three notes. You can have a major triad, or a minor triad, or a diminished triad, and so on. The better I've gotten at guitar, the more I've come to understand how fundamental triads are to the way the guitar players think about their instrument, and thus the way they develop their parts. On piano, you have 10 fingers and a ton of keys, 88 keys on a full-sized piano, so a triad only requires three of those fingers. It's very easy to stack two triads on top of one another, or not to even think about triads at all. You can build complex polychords like they're nothing on the piano. On the guitar, you don't have nearly as many options. There are six strings, and you have four fingers on your fretting hand. You can sometimes pull your thumb over onto that sixth string, but basically you have four fingers to work with, which means you're going to think largely in three and four note shapes, and triads fit really nicely into that. As a result, guitarists wind up using triads much more deliberately, picking and choosing which triad or which three or four note shape might sound best over which chord. It's a big reason that guitarists work so hard on mastering all of their triads and all of the inversions over every three-string set. The faster you can do that, the faster you become at moving from triad to triad, and the easier it is to come up with creative parts like, well, like this one. So this guitar part takes place up on the first three strings of the instrument. That first chord, remember, is a G6 chord. That means the guitar part just plays what amounts to an E minor triad. From there, the guitar part follows along with the song's chord progression, spelling out three-note ideas that keep pace with the chords without explicitly outlining them, and without moving quite as far up and down the instrument as the bass and the melody do, which creates a more steady, floating countermelody that stands in contrast to the rising, sinking harmony and melody played by the bass and vocals. It's hard not to think about the sky when talking about this song, mostly because of the title and the lyrics. It's about the sun. You're kind of looking up from the ground at a black hole sun. Also, I suppose because of that music video, I just can't ever fully remove it from how I conceive of this song. But if the bass and the melody are standing on the ground, this guitar countermelody is the shifting clouds above them. And that's an effect that's dramatically enhanced by that rotating Leslie speaker effect that's on the guitar. Leslie's speaker, which I've talked about in the past on this show, is a speaker often used by organ players, where the speaker itself has physically rotating elements that add this spinning chorus effect to the sound of the instrument. It can be sped up and slowed down. You'll hear it in a lot of organ solos where the organist will speed up the rotating effect to add this warbling sense of movement to each note. Now, I don't have a Leslie speaker. I'm just using a digital simulation to get kind of close to this effect, but I do think I can get close enough. This basic E minor guitar triad, which starts out the guitar part, becomes this. It's a great example of how big a difference a single guitar effect can make to a song's overall vibe, and I think it sounds really cool. Okay, so I'm going to assemble my full recreation of that verse, and I want you to listen back to it, first my version and then the actual recording, and I want you to really try to keep your ears open to everything that we just talked about. Try to listen to that bass line and hear how it moves along with the melody in that steady up and then downward trajectory. Hear how the melody sits on that E, emphasizing different chord tones as the chords change under the E, and try to also hear those rotating three-note guitar figures which move gently through the chord progression like hazy clouds floating above it all. Okay, ready? Here we go.
In the sun, in my disgrace.
The second verse follows the same basic outline as the first, as Cornell paints more abstract, unsettling imagery on top of an already woozy backdrop, moving through the same rising-falling progression as the band sets up the first chorus.
Black hole sun, won't you come? Wash away the rain. Black hole sun, won't you come? Won't you come? Won't you come?
So the word for this chorus is massive, but it's massive in a deep, patient, low way. That's something that's true across the chord progression, the arrangement, and the vocal melody. Soundgarden could definitely be high energy and high octane when they wanted to be, but the chorus of Black Hole Sun, it's a different kind of thing. It's more majestic. It doesn't drive, it strides. It doesn't shred, it churns.
Wash away the rain, Black Hole Sun.
The chord progression here is a collection of chords that we've already encountered on the verse, placed in a somewhat different order. The first chord is an E-flat major, with the melody climbing up to a B-flat, which is the fifth in that key, but has the effect of sounding like a minor third in G, which is the key of the song. The song often shifts between B-flat and B natural, bouncing between the sound of a G major and a G minor, and it's fun to keep an ear out for that. Here we walk from a G up to a B-flat, basically walking up a G minor scale, then the band drops down to a D chord, and the melody drops with it down to an A, but then it comes to a G major chord, and the melody shifts to a B natural. That bit of brightness is an interesting cracked window of light, similar to the times the B natural turns up in the verse. I really like how deliberately Cornell moves between major and minor thirds throughout this whole song. The second phrase follows the same chords and melody as the first one, ending this time on a C major, which goes straight to D, the 5 chord, which sets up the next verse, which begins once again on 1, G major. So let's recreate this chorus, but let's do it from the top down instead of from the bottom up, because I think that'll help make it clear just how important the bass and drums are to the massiveness of this chorus. So the guitar part here is interesting. It's similar to the intro guitar part in that it's using the very bottom of the instrument. It's very low, and it's actually pretty clear. This isn't a sludgy, dank, super distorted part, at least not the primary part, which is panned to the left. There is a secondary guitar part on the right that is somewhat more distorted. Cornell used what sounds like a number of different amps for this song. I looked around online. It looks like he liked Mesa Boogie and Marshall amps, so I set the Helix to use models based on those two amps. And I did push the amp for this. There's some distortion here, but nothing like you'd hear on a metal tune or anything like that. So I should say here for anyone wondering, I am using my Gibson 335 semi-hollow body for this. Cornell often played that type of guitar, though you could play something like a Les Paul for this too, and I'm sure it'd sound fine. I find a semi-hollow body is great for this sort of deeper, fuller sound, and also that's my favorite guitar and I like playing it for everything, so I was happy to have an excuse to play it for this. So I doubled that guitar part with a second, more distorted part and panned them hard to the left and the right, similar to how the recording is, to create a bigger soundscape. Now, I think this sounds pretty good and pretty big, but I think it's interesting to hear these guitar parts without the bass and drums, because it makes it clear just how essential those two parts are to creating a full rock sound. A couple years back, I had LA session guitarist Andrew Sinewick on the show, and we talked about a lot of fun stuff related to the guitar, and one of the things he mentioned was how sometimes people who hire him will ask him to create a huge Metallica-like metal sound, and he'll have to explain that you can't just do that with a single guitar track.
That's something I run into sometimes. I'll do these like orchestral things, and then they'll go, yeah, but we need it to sound like Metallica, like the Black Album. And, you know, and they're like, oh, just play... Here, play this one power chord part. And oh, it doesn't quite sound... It's like, yeah, nothing else about this sounds like the Black Album.
Right, I can't like, just pivot to that sound.
The groove is not the same. There's no drums. Like, you know, like... those guitars were at least quadrupled.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I do occasionally run into.
So just like it takes more than one guitar pass to get you the Black Album, it takes more than one guitar pass to get you the chorus to Black Hole Sun. If you take a single guitar part, you get this. If you double it and pan the two parts left and right, you get something bigger. Add bass, you get something bigger still. And it isn't really until you add bass and drums that you get the full enchilada. And regarding those drums, I really gotta say, this chorus is where Matt Cameron's style and musicality as a drummer really have a chance to shine. Cameron is an incredibly capable drummer, but he's never struck me as a flashy one, and that's part of what I love about his playing. His fills and grooves are placed just so. Each note is hit hard and squarely in its place with a deliberate and confident quality that conveys so much power and authority. Like, just listen to that fill that he plays to set up the chorus.
Black hole sun.
Boom, boom, boom. That's a pretty simple drum fill. It's not hard to play technically, but that's what makes it special. A great drummer can play something simple, just a few eighth notes and quarter notes down the drum set, and make it sound totally distinct.
Black hole sun.
I also want to shout out the way these drums were recorded. I think this recording sounds great in general, but that the drums sound particularly cool. Beinhorn and engineers Jason Corsaro and Adam Casper really came up with some interesting and distinct drum sounds for this album. You can hear the room in the drums as the drum sound bounces off the walls. It adds this sort of tight but very present energy around each hit.
Black hole sun.
The rest of Cameron's drum part stays true to that ferocious, restrained philosophy. He's playing really restrained and almost laying back on the beat throughout this chorus, just quarter notes up on a cymbal and a steady rock beat on the kick and the snare, but he places these occasional upbeat accent hits on other cymbals so deliberately that it lends a sort of gravitas to the whole song. More so than the bass and the guitars, the drums are what gives this chorus its musical energy. The last element of the chorus that I want to focus on is, of course, the melody and the lyrics. Cornell sounds great on this chorus, but what's remarkable about it to me is the fact that, like every other element of the band, the vocal melody is so restrained on this chorus. Like I've already mentioned, Chris Cornell had one of the great screams of all of modern rock. If you listen to Super Unknown, you'll hear him deploy it over and over again. I mean, listen to this guy, it's ridiculous. So that's a high D on The Day I Tried to Live. That's an unbelievably high note. By contrast, the chorus of Black Hole Sun never goes above a C, which is more than an octave below that note. It's a note that just about anybody can sing, and just about anyone could sing along with this whole chorus. To me, that contributes to this song's anthemic quality, and also to that sense of grandeur and restraint that permeates this chorus. And then there are the lyrics. Black hole sun, won't you come, wash away the rain. Black hole sun, won't you come, won't you come. Both in terms of lyrics and melody, it really does sound like something John Lennon might have written. And while the ultimate meaning of the song is open to interpretation, it's hard not to be swept along by it each time you hear it.
Black hole sun, won't you come, wash away.
So now let's go through my full recreation of that chorus, keeping your ears open for each element as I highlighted them. Listen to that guitar part, distorted but not overly so, doubled and panned out to the sides, left and right, with the bass playing a simple but crucial part down below, holding the guitars together, as the drums play with such restrained precision, dropping occasional accents every so often to keep things moving. With the melody never even climbing into the vocal mix, as Cornell makes his sweeping, pleading call for a cosmic intervention to wipe the slate clean. Ears on, here we go. It's so massive sounding, thanks in part to the mix, but largely to the arrangement and the choices that each musician is making. The second verse kicks off much the same as the first one. New lyrics over the same melody, the same woozy, vibey guitar part, the same gradual descent. I do love how Cornell sings this line. It's a great example of what a skilled vocalist Cornell was. I know I've made a big deal out of his scream because I kind of envy his ability to scream, but he had a phenomenal voice overall. He had great control and really knew how to use his instrument. Here, he pushes up to that high G and he really squeezes out the G with some compression. But then he releases on the way down and he goes into this light mix to keep. It's this gentle landing. What a great singer. From there, they transition into the second chorus, which starts out much the same as the first one. It's that same massive sound, and really, I mean, listen to this. There aren't that many notes being played in this chorus, and that's crucial because the most important thing for a sense of size is space. The second time through, they turn it around and repeat the chorus a second time, so it really just rolls on and locks into a groove. Setting up a post-chorus where Chris Cornell finally gets to wail a little bit. Specifically, a secondary lead vocal track that pans left and then right. It's understated, but you can feel the intensity ratcheting up. This post-chorus uses the same chords that they used to tie on that first repeated chorus, just a C major to a B flat major to a D major, never resolving back to G, instead just going to C and repeating the three-bar cycle. Here, let's try and recreate that sound. As Cornell increases the intensity by unleashing his upper register in the lead vocal part, the band gets ready to set up the most metal part of this song, the bridge. The bridge to Black Hole Sun doubles both as a broad instrumental feature for the band and as a guitar solo for Kim Thiel. Though due to the mix and the nature of his solo, it really does manage to be both at once. That's actually something that'll come up a few times this season. The best solos tend to be solos where, yes, one member of the band is stepping out and improvising, but due to the way that the musicians are playing together, it's really still an ensemble showcase. As one of my jazz improv teachers used to say, a soloist in a quartet might be playing more notes than anyone else on the stage, but they're never playing more than 25% of the music. Think about that one for a second. Before the solo, though, let's nail down this odd meter riff. It's a descending riff that starts on C, walks down to A, jumps up to C, and then ends on a little chromatic sequence. It sounds like this. As for the counting, it's in 9, but you could count it a few different ways. I always just count it as a bar of 4 and then a bar of 5, since that's how it sounds to me and that's what's comfortable for me. Like this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. However, I could see counting it differently. I think a drummer might feel it differently and just not think of it as explicitly in nine. You could break it up further. You could count four sets of 3/8 and then a bar of 3/4. I could see someone feeling more comfortable that way. That would sound like this. Here we go. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1. However you count it, it comes out to 9. The guitar and bass are both just doubling that riff together, which, for the sake of our recreation, is pretty straightforward. There is the matter of that guitar chord that ends the riff. It's a pretty cool sound, right? Very jangly and very intense. What tonality could that possibly be? So this season, the answer is always going to be Lydian whenever I ask a question like that. And what you're hearing here is a different kind of Lydian, less the dreamy sound that has come up on previous episodes and more of the jangly sound like, I don't know, a certain TV theme that I talked about way back in year one. The chord at the end of the riff on The Bridge to Black Hole Sun is an F Lydian, and it's less of a dreamy cloud and more of a thrown elbow. Now I've been using F Lydian and F major 7 sharp 4 kind of interchangeably here. If I was being precise, I would say this is an F major 7 sharp 4 chord, and that specific chord, F major 7 sharp 4, is a really common chord in guitar-based songs because there's an open B string on a standard tuned guitar. The B string is right there, and it's pretty easy to wind up playing an F chord with an open B string ringing, and it sounds really nice, especially if you leave that first string, the E string, ringing as well. That's got a major 7th, which is also in Lydian. So basically fingering an F major chord and leaving the top two strings ringing, it's a great sound, and that's why it's in a bunch of different songs. And that's what they're doing here as well. This bridge is as much a feature for Matt Cameron's drumming as it is for anyone else. He lays it down with his usual resolute style. He's gone up to the bell in place of the hi-hat, which, along with his syncopated hits and carefully chosen fills, gives the whole groove a more open, rolling feel. Put that all together and you have a pretty rock-solid foundation for a guitar solo. Now on to this solo. Kim Thiel's solo on Black Hole Sun rules, and it's a great example of what I've come to call a kite and anchor solo. Sometimes a soloist locks closely with what the rest of the ensemble is playing, and some soloists will even defy my improv teacher and play fewer notes than, say, the drummer or the pianist, despite being the one playing the solo. Sometimes, though, a soloist will do something different. They'll fly free of the band entirely, loosening up their approach to time, feel, and harmony, until they've flown into the heavens. They've become a kite, still tethered to the anchor of the rest of the band, but only by a string. Sometimes they'll drift up to the very highest reaches, and then sometimes they'll come closer to the earth before drifting up again. This concept first came up on the show way back when I did an episode on Rush's song Tom Sawyer. Alex Lifeson's solo on that song is a textbook example of a kite and anchor solo. A kite and anchor solo is defined by trust. A soloist can trust that they can release themselves to paint on a broader rhythmic and harmonic canvas, and that when they decide to return to Earth, the rest of the band will be there waiting for them. You hear what I'm talking about, right? Now, I don't have Thiel's chops, particularly his super fast left hand trills, so rather than try to transcribe his solo, I went ahead and constructed my own little kite. I dialed up the gain on the amp, I ran my guitar through a wah and some delay, and I combined some familiar shapes, A minor, which is broadly the key of this section, with some more unusual sounds, whole tone, Lydian, also just making weird noises with the guitar. I really tried to allow myself to just let go and not worry about where the beat was or what the band was doing, and to allow myself to try to paint with a broader contour than each 9-beat segment of the song. It was a really fun exercise, and it took a bunch of takes for me to get comfortable. If any of you out there mess around with improvising, I recommend giving this kind of thing a shot. While what you're playing may be energetic, try to actually relax as you play, pulling higher and higher up away from the anchor of the band. It's an almost meditative experience once you get into the flow. Okay, so let's hear all that kitey weirdness in the full context of my recreation. And I want you to open your ears to everything that's going on all at once. Catch how the bass and the rhythm guitar are doubling that riff together, with the guitar ringing out that jangly F Lydian sound at the end of each phrase. Listen for the drums up on the bell of the ride cymbal, with a broad, rolling groove punctuated by carefully chosen fills. And then on top of that, listen to the guitar solo, first my just for fun attempt, and then Kim Thiel's much better solo, flying like a kite into the heavens, letting go of the groove and the harmony to make a statement that derives meaning from the distance it places between itself and the rest of the ensemble. Ears on, pedals pushed, here we go. Enough of me. Let's listen to Kim do it. It's pretty amazing, right? When you focus on Thiel's playing, the groove almost melts away and you're left in this floating, almost impressionistic cloud of sound and energy. So in between the guitar solo and the final chorus, I guess you'd call that a microverse. I really like that a lot. It's kind of the third verse, but it's so short. It's just enough time for each element of the verse to return. The descending bass line, the warbly Leslie guitar, Cornell's more exposed blues-inflected vocal stylings that he does on the verse.
Till you all just disappear.
And a pretty killing drum fill.
Black hole sun, won't you come?
And then it's time for the chorus out, which takes us to the end of the song. And that secondary hard pan lead vocal part returns as Cornell screams the title of the song. Which adds this feeling of sublimated desperation beneath this otherwise stately song. And really, that's Black Hole Sun. It's a case study in controlled, carefully crafted rock, merging Soundgarden's distinct blend of heavy metal, rock, and pop influences into a song that was and remains one of the defining sounds of a decade. And that'll do it for my analysis of Black Hole Sun, a song that I definitely no longer find scary. I had a great time putting this analysis together, and I came to really appreciate Chris Cornell's songwriting. We lost him not that long ago in 2017, and it was such a great loss for him to go so young, a loss for all the stories he could have told, and of course, all the music that he didn't have a chance to make. He was one of the greats, and I hope this episode helps reaffirm that. Thank you all out there for listening, and thanks in particular to anyone who takes the opportunity to spread the word or to leave a review of the show. I don't do very much marketing for Strong Songs. I rely almost entirely on word of mouth to get new listeners, so it really means a lot when I hear from folks who like the show enough to share it with their friends. And when people do hear about the show, the first thing that they'll see are user reviews wherever they're going to listen. So if you like Strong Songs, I hope you'll consider leaving a review wherever you listen to the show. Of course, this all wouldn't be happening without my patrons. Thanks to you all. And of course, if you want to chip in and directly support Strong Songs, you can do that at patreon.com/strongsongs, or you can send a one-time donation using the link in the show notes. This episode was made with production support from Emily Williams. Thanks, Emily. And thanks, too, to Galen Clark for talking some of this song's harmony through with me. Season 6 will continue in 2 weeks with a very different pick in a very different style. If you want to listen to that episode right now, well, you can go become a patron. Otherwise, I'll see you in 2 weeks with what should be a very interesting, very fun episode of Strong Songs. Until then, take care and keep listening.